Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. We are Three Women, Three Ways. We're the radio show that talks about current events, things that are important in people's lives, and we look at all of these things from our three different perspectives, different from educational, different from work experience, and different from each other. Politically, we all have a different take on it, but we're all interested in getting information out there, and we would like you to join us. Today we have a very interesting topic, and it's human trafficking, and a lot of people have been hearing a little bit about human trafficking, but we're here to kind of explore it. And let's introduce ourselves. First of all, I'm Heather Stark, and I'm working on a PhD in psychology, and I come from the background of working with the issues in domestic violence for the last 10 or 12 years or so. And over here to my left is Pinkley. Pinkley, you want to introduce yourself?
Well, good morning. Good morning, ladies. Good morning, listeners. This is Pinkley or Connie Sue Pinkley, however you want to say that. I am a survivor of domestic violence and have been in the work for the last 15 years. Started as a volunteer and in a local domestic violence sexual assault agency. Got my BA in social justice at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And the more we explore topics, the more they become complicated to me. And I'm very much interested in this show today. And by no means are we experts, but we're certainly exploring a very complicated and difficult issue on human trafficking. Deb, how about you? Wanted to introduce yourself.
Well, sure. Thanks. Good morning to you, my sisters, and my sister Divas, and to the world at large. I have about 20 years' experience plus personal experience, and my tagline is I've lived it, I've studied it, and I've worked it. And so
what is
domestic violence specifically, but all forms of violence against women. And in the last, I would say the last 6 years, I've kind of been learning more and more about trafficking because it came to my attention when I was the sheltered director at our local nonprofit domestic violence agency. That's how I really first became involved with it. So, and that's an interesting story in of itself. But we want to invite our guests to call in today. Our call-in number is 646-378-0430. And Heather, are you staffing our chat room?
I am. It's trying to connect right now, so I might have problems connecting the server, but please try and join us, and I'll try and figure out what my problems are, and we'll welcome you into our conversation today. You know, when I was doing a little research last night, ladies, I didn't know a whole lot about human trafficking, so just about all of it was new to me, and I was appalled at the extensive nature of this particular problem. I mean, people just don't seem to be talking about it very much. I know that some police forces and enforcement agencies like the FBI have been really involved in an effort to get a handle on human trafficking. But what exactly is it? What is human trafficking? I mean, are we selling, grabbing people off the streets and putting them, on slow boats to wherever and using them to clean dungeons or whatever? Is it all sexual slavery? What is it?
Okay, I got a little bit of information on that. Trafficking is a coerced or forced activity, and it's usually an illegal activity. And there are several different types of human trafficking, and here's a short list. Forced labor, sex trafficking, bonded labor, where there's a debt that they have to work off. There's also debt bondage among migrant laborers. There's involuntary domestic servitude. There's forced child labor. There's child soldiers and child sex trafficking. just to name a few, and this doesn't even bring up which one that's getting more notoriety lately is where people are being grabbed off the streets and then surgery to remove different organs from their body to sell on the black market. So there are some really atrocious, violent activities related to human trafficking.
Now, why should I care? Because that just happens on big streets, like in dark alleys in San Francisco or with runaway children. So if that's not my issue, why should I care?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because what we want our listeners and the world in general to realize is that this is not an other world problem. This happens in the United States in our own backyard. In fact, Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Oregon are in the top three cities as being known for great for traffickers and trafficking. For the rest of the world, we have the Interstate 5 freeway, which goes from Canada to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of big cities along that route, as well as a lot of truck stops. And so it's kind of like a haven for this kind of illegal activity. And when I first started learning about it, I learned that our local mall is kind of like the playground for traffickers, and that really disturbed me, because I remember as a teenager going to our mall with my friends and kind of hanging out, and I know that my grandkids always are talking about going to the mall, and so my red flag monitor went like haywire every time I heard the mall after that.
Oh, yeah.
So
if I'm a farm girl out in Idaho in the country, I don't have to worry about this?
This is not true. Traffickers are very sophisticated, and they have a really good grooming game. And they are on the lookout for people that are vulnerable. And by vulnerable, we mean maybe lonely or feeling mistreated, young, innocent.
Misunderstood,
exactly.
I mean, I would say the teens or the tweens are probably of a really vulnerable age to be attracted.
Exactly, and the average age of girls, mostly girls, there are boys too, that get trafficked in the United States is 12 to 14.
Oh, my golly.
So they
don't even know what's going on.
Yeah, they like to get them early, and they usually begin a relationship with them. I don't know if we've talked about this much in relationship with domestic violence, which we all have a very personal tie to, but there's this, you know, trust built and relationship built, and it's not like the violence doesn't usually start the first time you meet them or, you know, become involved with a perpetrator of these types of crimes. So the young girls often refer to their pimps as daddy or my boyfriend. And they will come in and they will say, I love you. I'll take care of you. I'm the only one that understands you. You want something, they'll buy them nice clothes or do manicures, take them places, feed them nice, you know, really take care of them. And then all of a sudden, once the trafficker or pimp feels like they've got them, you know, kind of tucked in cozily, then they'll start training them to be prostitutes. So that's a really insidious process.
So that whole grooming thing is basically being charming and nice and pretending that you're the only one who really understands and cares about this person. And then they basically fool the person into, especially a young person who, you know, probably doesn't have a lot of enough experience to be cynical about something like that. And they fool them into thinking that they're friends, that they have their best interests at heart.
Absolutely.
And then once the hook is set.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And what they do also is they remove them from their immediate area where they're comfortable and know their way around. They'll often take their cell phones away from them, and they'll give them a new one so the family has no way to contact them. So here in where we live, all three of us, right on the freeway, Interstate 5, it's real easy to get to a freeway and relocate someone fairly quickly. And they keep doing that. They move them around at night so they don't see the road signs very well, you know, things like that, and keep them very isolated. And it's really quite a horrific.
Well, I mean, when you have something like that, I imagine it's very easy to just break a person. One of the articles that I was reading was an article in a police chief magazine, it's called, and they talk, of course, it addresses professional police officers about how to deal with this kind of issue. And one of the things that the article pointed out is that it's hard to tell what is human trafficking. It's hard for people to tell the victims. And it sounds to me like the victims don't really, they're just so brainwashed, if you will, that they can't, they don't even see themselves as being victimized. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, they see this person as their protector. And even if, you know, there's the whole leaving and going back thing that happens, which is very similar to domestic violence and sexual assault by itself, is that, you know, they miss the good parts of that, what they perceive were the good parts of that relationship, not understanding that they're children and, you know, don't necessarily know the difference. So I have some statistics here that you may find interesting. In the state of Louisiana, they identified a young victim of sex trafficking of being 6 years old.
Oh,
and the other thing is, I know we're going to talk about this, is there's a lack of resources, but so I'll leave that for later. But I wanted to read this. There are 27 million people in bondage worldwide. Within 48 hours, one in three runaways will be approached by a pimp. 77% of all adult prostitutes were trafficked into trade as children. The trafficking industry earns more than $32 billion per year. And one out of 100 victims of trafficking are ever rescued or released. So it's a big problem here in the United States, and that's what we have to really, I think that's one of the main messages we want to get out to our listeners, is that this is happening in your own backyard.
Yeah. So it's an international problem, but it's also a problem right here for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm thinking Deborah, of all the news media, every time a child is abducted or every time a child comes up missing, now I'm wondering how many of those are missing because of this whole human trafficking thing.
Absolutely, and that's the thing that I think of now whenever I hear of a family that's lost their child. And often if it's a teenage, it's titled a runaway. And so it's like as if it's a runaway, that means we don't have to look for them. That means we don't need to get them back home safely, or shouldn't that just amp up our efforts to find that young person and get them into some safe situation? Because we know our streets are brutal.
Yeah. Please give us a call and join in this very important conversation. The phone number is 1-646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. It sounds to me like this is such a prevalent problem. I think I've had my head in the sand for so long, just not even thinking that this was a huge issue. I always thought it was something, you know, in big cities for that only affected, you know, a few people. But wow, this is opening my eyes. Pinkley, you had some personal experience, didn't you, with a human trafficking situation?
Well, it wasn't a personal experience. It was an experience that
as an agency, as a domestic violence and sexual assault agency that we were working with, and it was quite a complicated situation that I'll just briefly talk about, which will, I think, ask the end question to it is what services are available for survivors, victims of human trafficking. Right now, before I get into that, I really want to talk about a little bit about a phone number where people can call in. There is a National Human Trafficking Resource Center. It is available 24/7, and that number is 1-888-373-7888. So that's an interesting way how they've posted this number to remember, 1-888-3737-888. And it's the Polaris Project, and I know Deb can talk a lot more about this. She's more familiar with the project itself. But I really want to start this by saying that they're identifying this as a modern-day slavery, the word slavery, epidemic. So if you think about it in slavery terms, I think that it really amps up or heightens the idea about wrapping your brain around this, that it's not happening in another country. It is happening right here. So just real quickly, we had a call come in from actually an FBI agent into our helpline that wanted us to shelter approximately 6 women that were what they call a sweep. They came into an environment that were where there were a multitude of people, not just one, but a multitude. Like there was, I think I remember there was somewhere around 20 women plus. And these women happened to be not American citizens that they could tell. So they were, what's the word? They were wearing ankle bracelets.
Ankle bracelets? You mean like handcuffs for your ankles?
Yes.
No, they're the GPS things. Like they usually give them to parolees when they come out of prison to know where they're at all times.
Yeah,
tracking device.
An ankle bracelet tracking device. Right. They did. So the idea was, is if they put these tracking devices on these women, they wouldn't leave the area, because what they wanted them to do is be witnesses in the prosecution. They would not have a case without their cooperation. So basically the option was is to put them into ICE or detention, or to have them sheltered by a local agency, whether that be a DV or SA, domestic violence or sexual assault agency or a homeless shelter. So, of course, we immediately knew that these were victims of sexual assault and wanted to provide as many resources and shelter if we had space available. But it went against the theory of empowerment, that we wanted to support people who wanted to make their own decisions about what they wanted to do. So it really put us in a very precarious situation, because if someone came to us and said, you know, I really don't want this ankle bracelet on me, we would not facilitate that from happening, but we would support their idea or belief about, this is not working for me. I don't want to be part of the prosecution. So we found ourselves in a very, very precarious situation. As it turned out, we could not bring these women in because we would be part of the FBI investigation. And they also wanted access to them at any time, day or night, to start their testimony, to get a case for the prosecution. So it was very criminal-based focused. It was not really about providing support to the survivors, which is what
is what our agency in domestic violence and sexual assault services and is about. It's about confidential services. So it was really quite a complicated situation. And I really got to thinking, what are the services available for survivors of human trafficking?
Well, before we go into any kind of list of resources, let's just say there are zero real resources, because I think our domestic violence, anti-violence against women movements have given the public the idea that we have shelters that are safe and unlocatable. You know, you can't find them.
Yeah.
And so anybody who needs to be protected, whether it's from a brutal crime, we've had people say, we don't have any witness protection funds, can we put them in your shelter? No, you can't. People come into our shelters of their own free will. There's no forcing, and they can leave when they want to. We don't lock them down. We don't monitor their every movement. So we can't really facilitate that kind of support for a criminal investigation, if you want to call it support. But that's how I first became aware of it too, Pinkley, is Portland, Oregon came to us and said, we're going to do a sweep. We expect to have maybe 6 to 20 victims. Do you have room in your shelter for them? And we were like, well, do they want to come?
Nice.
How do I know they want to come? You know, there was just a bazillion questions that ran through our mind, and we were open to, at that point, they weren't sophisticated enough with the GPS tracking bracelets to say that that would be an option, but it never worked out. But there's another kind of trafficking, too, that we haven't really mentioned, and that is brides.
Ooh.
Marriage brokers and that sort of thing. And now we have in our shelter worked with quite a few people who were brought from their countries to marry a U.S. citizen, and it became abusive. So for that kind of trafficking, yeah, we were like the exact answer for that. But as far as domestic sex trafficking, and we don't, our system's not set up to shelter under 18 without parents there, right, Connie Sue?
Yep, that's right.
So, you know, there's all kinds of laws in each state about how you can house juveniles, and the fact that the way they want to treat this is interesting. And Heather, you had a conversation with somebody about that, right? The conversation about victim versus criminal?
Yes. A friend of mine has actually done a lot of work with human trafficking, and particularly teenagers. And her major frustration is that when a teenage prostitute is arrested, she's seen as a perpetrator. She's a criminal. But in fact, in so many of those cases, that girl is a victim of human trafficking. But instead of being perceived as a victim, she's being perceived as a criminal, thrown into jail, offered no support, and then turned out as soon as her pimp comes and gets her out of jail without any resources, without any assistance, without any referrals, with nothing, because she's seen as a prostitute, not as a victim of human trafficking. And so, as you mentioned before, these people, these traffickers, usually transport these women to places that they have no idea where they are. And so the idea that they could just walk away and get police assistance is kind of a ridiculous notion. They don't even know where they are.
They don't know where
they
are.
All they know is that if they don't go along with it and do this, there's probably a lot of pain coming. The other issue, of course, is the drugs. Traffickers will also use drugs. They'll use whatever they can, violence, whatever, to maintain control over that person.
Absolutely.
So the whole idea is that how does a police force or how does a community tell if someone is choosing to break the law and, you know, in order to earn money or whatever, and how can they tell which of these people are being forced to do this, and how can they be prepared to treat them differently, or should they? It's a really complicated issue, I think.
It is. And the fact that the child prostitute, if you will, which is an awful strong word for a child being forced to do sex acts, is that their pimps are telling them now at this point that you're nothing but a prostitute. You know, that if you run away, they're going to put you in jail.
Yep.
You know, so it's also used as a weapon against them, the language and the way the system works, which is the case in almost all forms of violence against women, is you use the systems against the victim survivor, as well as the force and the coercion and emotions and all those things. And so, yeah, it's a process. So I've had the pleasure of being a moderator of a group of sex traffic survivors, and what they have shared in their discussions with each other is that they were often locked in closets or locked in bedrooms. If they had children, their children were taken away from them. They were given drugs all the time, and often their pimps would drive them to the street where they were supposed to work that night and say, don't come home until you have $300. And if you don't have $300, don't come home until you have $300. And they're like, well, we couldn't go home until we had $300. If we did, we would be subjected to cavity searches and beatings, violence, and torture, and those kinds of things. So it's to me, there's really no choice in this, even as an adult, especially if you were brought into it as a child. And it's hard for me to say that anybody in these situations of trafficking should be looked at as a criminal, you know, or processed through our judicial system as a criminal. What do you think about that?
Binkley, we haven't heard from you. You want to throw in your 2 cents worth here?
Well, I 100% agree. I have no argument against that. I think that it's just atrocious. Sorry, I'm a little distracted here. I'm reading this article about the first ever Day Springs in Tulsa, Oklahoma, shelter for victims of trafficking. And just what you were saying, Deb, this one girl is saying that she had to go into therapy just to learn how to eat again.
Yeah.
That she was not able to eat until she had met her quota.
Yeah. Yeah, really insidious and brutal violence is used to control and contain and restrict their...
I think it's important to point out, too, it's just not the threat against their own person, but against family and friends. Like, they will, you know, I know where you live. I mean, just they're protecting their families.
Yeah. Or, I know you have a little sister. I'm going to go get her and bring her into this. You know, that's what some of the survivors would say. And that was pretty motivating for them to do what they could to prevent that from happening, knowing what they were doing. So, yeah, that's a real threat to anybody that's in that kind of situation, because, number one, you probably don't want your family to know you're in that situation. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I still think there's a lot of shame involved, even though it's not within your control. You're feeling shamed and humiliated that you have to do these acts.
Well,
so,
I wanted to go into, I guess my reaction right now, I'm just a little bit... reactionary, thinking about the people in this world that actually support this activity. And I'm talking about the people that actually go out and buy the prostitutes or
mm-hmm.
the market
activities, the market
for these. Yeah.
Yeah,
That's a good point.
You know,
so
it's your daughter, it's your daughter, it's your sister, it's your mother. I mean, we all have females in our life, but yet they compartmentalize, well, this is just a prostitute, or this is just someone who has decided that this is what they want to make as a, do as a living.
Right.
But in fact, they're victims, and they continue to victimize these women, women, children, men, all people, and actually continue to support this. So I'm a little outraged by that right now at this moment.
Well, that makes me flash on something,
Pinkley,
about they called prostitution a victimless crime. It's sounding
mm-hmm.
less and less like a victimless crime to me.
Yes, it is, definitely. So here's what I know. There's been some movement with advocacy services, and we were talking before the show started about a lot of interest with faith-based and religious-based organizations wanting to provide services. And so the law enforcement is gradually getting the kind of training where they can start to recognize that it is a trafficking situation, and they are choosing not to prosecute the children. They're trying to get the pimps, but that is a whole nother process, like we said, because can you use children in that way? You know, it's kind of an ethical question. To make them face, it's really a difficult thing, because when anybody in the U.S. is charged with a crime, they have the right to face their accuser in their trial. So you have a child who's been tortured, and now you have to testify against this monster, right, this criminal. So those are difficult things to work around. But there is a move towards more survivor victim services for the prostitutes. And I know that some jurisdictions have developed something they call John School. And what that is the men get arrested, and then part of their rehabilitation is to attend John School, where they have to go to a class and they have to be learn about the impacts of their action on society and the children that they choose. And it used to be also a defense for perpetrators of the crime, the Johns, if you will. They would say, well, I didn't know she was under 18. She told me she was 18. And so in Washington State, our law has been adjusted enough to say that that no longer is an acceptable defense. You know a child when you see one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
Not up to the child to tell you. You need to make sure who you're claiming to have consensual sex with. So there's some movement in that area as far as that. And so I don't want to say there's no resources, but it's pretty limited and it's few and far between.
And that is if you can even get to a resource.
Right.
I mean, those are resources that are available are for people that can actually access them. When you have your cell phone taken away and have no outside communication, how can you even access?
And you're afraid to go to the police. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and you won't have any money, remember, because that's the first thing they take from you is the money. You don't get any of that money. That all goes to the pimp or the daddy or the boyfriend, however they choose to be called. And oftentimes, this is another really, there's a tattooing. The pimps will tattoo their girls with their brand, so that if they run away and some other pimp approaches them, they know who they belong to and they'll return them. So it's kind of a pimp brotherhood there. But the survivors that I worked with, all of them had tattoos, and most of them wanted that tattoo removed or you know, at least changed so it didn't remind them of that particular period of their lives. And most of the survivors that I had the honor and pleasure to talk with, it took them years just years, literally years, to come to a point where they were feeling, you know, somewhat like an average human being again.
I can imagine. I mean, have everything taken away from you. I just can't even imagine how horrible that must be to try and get past. Please, in this conversation, phone number 646-378-0430. Give us a call. Check in with us and let us know what you know about human trafficking or what about this conversation has kind of surprised and shocked you. Go ahead, Bailey. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Connie Sue.
Oh, no, I wasn't saying anything.
I was going to say that I did find an internet resource, and it is a live chat resource, and the ad, it's called removingchains.org. And so you can go to this website, and you can create a profile. You give yourself a username and a password, and then you can sign in, and the different chat rooms they have are there's adults and under 18, and then there's abuse support rooms. One of the groups is adults abused as kids. Then there's child trafficking support, family and friends of victims. Another chat room is female survivors only. Another one is male survivors only. Another one is institutional ritual support. And then there's a couple that say they're illness-related. So there's a chat room for people who suffer depression and other forms of mental health. There's another chat room for sick or disabled. And then they have some for under 18. There's four groups for under 18-year-olds. Bullying support, child abuse support, depression and self-harm support, and sick and disabled kids. So, and you can go in and you can click on one of those rooms, and they're supposed to be, their goal is to have it monitored by a safe person, the people running the website. I haven't had the opportunity to go in and actually try the chat, but I will post this on our Facebook page to remind you all that it's there if you're listening and you want that information later. But I think it could be, I mean, it's a safe and an anonymous, as safe as you can get and anonymous, so that's a pretty low threat of way to seek support, if you get what I mean when I say that.
Yeah. Well, what's the likelihood that a victim who's being currently victimized would be able to access the chat room? I would think that that's mostly for people who've already gotten away.
Right.
Yeah.
People who have separated from that, exactly. But I was just thinking when my friends in the survivor group said it has taken them years, and I've actually had some, you know, private conversations with them, and you know, when you need support on something, you need support on it. And if you, it's easier if you go to someone who understands what you're talking about. So if you're in that type of situation, this might be a viable resource for you.
Yeah. Yeah, you were just saying it. It's probably not something that you can learn to live with very easily.
No, and we don't want to stereotype or generalize. We don't want to say it's only runaway children or only those that are homeless that are victims of trafficking. And I know a family whose daughter was trafficked at 17. She's now like 23. And her stepdad was a retired police officer, and her mom is in corporate world in the hotel chains. And she pretty much had all the things she needed. She was going to school. She had a nice house. But she got involved through the internet in a chat room with this guy. And this guy presented himself as younger than he was, like in his early 20s. And they started meeting for coffee, and then they'd go to his house. And what ended up being, though, was when she would go to his house, he was slipping drugs into her drinks. So she became addicted without knowing she was even being given drugs. And then his grooming process, you know, finally convinced her to just move in with him. And because I think in that process she turned 18, so she, but she didn't tell her mom and dad she was moving out. But he, the pimp guy, took her phone and would text her parents saying, "Hey, yeah, I'm okay. I'll talk to you later." So the parents had no idea their daughter was being trafficked at this point, because that's what he would do. He got her hooked on the drugs and then said, "Well, you got to earn money to pay for this drugs now. Mm-hmm. I can't pay for it for you." So he'd put her out on the street. And she got away because he put her on the street, and then he took drugs in the car while he was sitting there watching her from, you know, a few feet away, and he, like, overdosed. So he had to, he got taken to the hospital, and then they were charging him. They found out he was, like, 35, and he had a history of doing this, like, 3 or 4 times previous to her. And she just denied it all the way up until he was actually in court, and then somehow something clicked with her. Her parents, you know, thought treatment options for her, and she had to get clean and sober. And, you know, the good thing is now she's going to college and she's trying to help other survivors. But, it, you know, she said, "My pimp didn't look like what you think a pimp would look like. He looked like us, you know. He was a white guy. He wasn't a gang member or a member of organized crime."
Or what was, we would stereotypically think of.
What we would stereotypically think of it, yes.
Yeah. So, Deb, talk a little bit about the 10K. I think that as we near the end of our show here in just a little bit, that I'd like to put a positive spin, if we can, on what people are doing. You had mentioned the GEMS project in New York.
Right. So, and Heather, you're usually the one that likes to talk about this, is what can we do? What can we do?
Yes.
And so there's actually a group of men that's called 10K Men, and they're talking about accepting some responsibility and working to prevent and eradicate this, right? You watched it too, Connie Sue?
I did. I watched the trailer on it, yeah.
It's not very long. The trailer is only about a minute and a half.
Right, but no, I didn't watch the documentary.
Yeah. So it's good to know that we have good, strong allies in this work. And the first place that I knew about that is for not adults, you know, under 18, was in New York City, and it's called GEMS. It's GEMS. And they don't offer shelter, but they have what they call a day project. And so usually the girls are pretty much left to their own during the day, so they can actually go out and shop and do some things if they have the trust of their pimp. So they could go to this GEMS place and use the computer and the phone and eat some food and hang out with other people, and even get, like, GED classes and those sorts of things. And so they're a very successful program. And they are started by a woman named Rachel Lloyd, who herself was trafficked as a young woman. So, and they are recognized across the nation as kind of a leader in our work, and they have several grants with the government. And they are on the National Human Trafficking Task Force that was just pulled together by President Obama and his administration this past year.
So Deb and Heather, let's talk about what GEMS, let's mention what the acronyms stand for. Girls Educational and Mentoring Services.
Yep.
And we just want to let our listeners know also that January is Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and so I just wanted to pop those two in there. I'm on their website right now, looking at it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's definitely a topic.
Empowerment model focus for her work, so
right.
I can get behind her work and what she's doing.
I think this is definitely a topic where, you know, we definitely need to raise awareness on this. I mean, I've been going blithely along thinking that, yeah, I know that happens, but not around here. And this has really opened my eyes. It's just an amazing issue. And I keep thinking, putting myself in the position of some of these young people who are victimized over again when they're arrested for doing what they're being forced to do.
Right. There's also a big push for juvenile services to incorporate, get trained on trafficking and be able to identify them early on. And they may be in juvenile hall for prostitution or maybe a petty crime of some kind. But if they can recognize the trafficking piece of that, then they can start reaching out to, you know, different places to get what they need rather than just continually go back and or pretend it isn't happening. And I think that's probably what keeps the young people going back there is when they look to adults to know and to save them from these things. And if we have our heads in the sand and we're not acknowledging it and we're not saying to our children that I'm going to do what I can to get you safe, then they feel even more desolate and more lonely, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that they must.
Yeah.
Boy, what a tough thing. So tell me, you know, like you were saying, Pinkley, let's see if we can find something positive. What is the rate of people, how can I phrase this question, how many people actually successfully get away? Do we know?
Well, I don't know. And when you ask that question, the idea of statistics pop up, and the statistics are based on what's reported.
Mm-hmm.
And how many survivors or victims are actually a part of those statistics? How many actually are reported? And then compared to how many that we don't know go unreported, just like sexual assault and domestic violence and sexual abuse, we only know of what's happening. People that have come forward or have gone to the police and now they're part of a statistical system. So I think when we talk about statistics and what we can do about it, I want to remind ourselves that we're trying to open the door for people to come forward, and the thought about there are safe havens, there are places for people to go, and I just am baffled by this topic that we're sharing this morning with our listeners, and I know that Deb has been working in this for quite some time, and I haven't really paid, honestly, that much attention to it because it's overwhelming. And Deb made this statement, human trafficking is like domestic violence on steroids.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that, Deb?
Well, I mean, the three of us have a great deal of experience with the topic of domestic violence. And so I think we would call ourselves expert in the field of anti-domestic violence work. But so trafficking is very much like all the things that happen to someone who is in an abusive relationship, but it is intensified. You know, it's not just a punch in the eye, it's a severe beating. You're locked in rooms, you're restricted and you're watched 24 hours. And then your pimp is telling you that this is for your own good and it's because I love you, baby, and you're my girl, you know, I'll die protecting you. And so for those who are still children who don't have the emotional maturity to see through that, because even as adults, it's really hard to see through that. So, I mean, it's intensified. It's 100 times worse, if you can imagine. And the three of us know what we've lived through with domestic violence. I think human trafficking is worse. It's a higher extreme level of violence, and it's a 24/7 type of violence. Because even if you aren't being physically brutally beaten, you're being coerced to sell your body and be with, you know, on the street, out in the cold. You don't know who you're with. You might have to have drugs to just do what you have to do to survive. And so that's what I mean. Steroids is kind of a drug that a lot of athletes take to increase their strength and their competitiveness, and often they have violent rages along with taking steroids. So that's why I kind of made that analogy of domestic violence on steroids.
Well, so I want to just quickly argue that point. I agree with, but I want to argue it also. I think that by saying it's worse, it diminishes the travesty of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and domestic violence. It's another form of violence against women. And it's not just women. Men, little boys, young teens are involved in this. So I would take both sides of that.
Yeah.
Because it minimizes the horrificness of what a survivor may be experiencing. I do want to point out, just on the upside of this, is that there is a human trafficking project called Real Men Don't Buy Sex.
Mm.
And so I think it's really, the onus is on, it's our responsibility to understand the human suffering and recognize that this is happening in our community. There's just no way around it. Whether, you know, I will never look at someone the same way who's working in an industry that supposedly that they've chosen to get into, such as prostitution or a brothel or a child who's been gone missing. I think that the question raises now for me always is, wow, has someone abducted that person to go into human trafficking? So there is a website. It's called the Trafficking Project. It was an organization of men that started in 2006. It's the Defenders USA, the unique campaign of males speaking out against sex trafficking. And Real Men Don't Buy Sex. It's where is the human responsibility and the accountability for the people that are buying into this industry?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because, you know, human trafficking is built on the capitalist theory. You know, the demand part is so huge.
But if you don't have a consumer, you don't
That's
have
right.
the consumerism, then you don't have the demand. You don't have the product.
Right. Exactly.
And
so we have to get everybody in the world to realize that human beings are not objects to be used for sexual gratification in any way.
And that it is a part, if we can equate it to a modern day slavery. I mean, look how long it took us to get out of the slavery. You know, how many years has it taken? And it's baffling to think that it's being equated to that as modern day slavery, which it is. So I say a part of it is the responsibility of the people who are the consumers,
mm-hmm.
and that online, that means in person. And I think that when you depersonalize it by going into a chat room or going into, you know, watching pornography or whatever that is, child pornographers, you know, child pornography, it's like, do you think that those children are there at their own free will? No. They have been trafficked.
Yeah.
Well, I think what you bring up a really hot button for me, and that is the notion of empathy. I think that a normal human being who has any empathy in his soul would not just be able to look at a woman or a child as an object for their pleasure. And I think that you can teach empathy to a certain degree. And I think that one of the best ways that we can try to teach the customers, the consumers of these businesses, is to equate it to, you know, that's somebody's sister, that's somebody's child, that's somebody's mother. You know, make these human beings, not just objects to be used.
Right.
And I think that as a society, we do a terrible job of that. We just do a terrible, terrible job trying to instill empathy in people. Last week when we were talking about the Steubenville, Ohio rape situation, and I mentioned that I had watched the video, and way off in the distance in the background, you could hear a boy say, "What if that was your sister?"
Yeah.
And I was just so taken aback that there was at least one person there who saw this girl as a human being, not as an object.
And but only one.
It sounds to me like this whole human trafficking thing, we're talking turning generations of people into objects for
right.
others to use.
Right. I don't think that that's the only strategy we can work on. We have to have a broad range of strategies, right?
Yes.
But I think I really like the idea of men holding men accountable. You know, so this 10,000 men trailer that we mentioned earlier and the organizations that Connie Sue brought up, that's encouraging to me. And I also have seen an increase in resources for people who are out of the life, as they call it. And in San Francisco, there's a group called SAGE, S-A-G-E, for survivors. And in Los Angeles, there's a group called CAST, C-A-S-T. And so you can find both of those groups on the Internet to look them up to see what services they are offering. And both of those organizations are survivor-led and survivor-centered services, which, you know, I don't know about you two, but I wholeheartedly support that it be driven and motivated from that point of perspective.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are a lot of things in this world I don't think you have to experience in order to understand, but I think that when you're talking something at this level, how could I possibly understand what somebody's lived through like that, you know? The good point is
Heather, we do have the empathy.
Mm-hmm.
We have the feeling and the understanding and the compassion for people who are being traumatized like this, so... and we need more people to step up and acknowledge that they do have the empathy for that instead of the denial that it's in our own backyards. That's what I keep saying. It's in our backyards. It's at my mall, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
We had a case where someone was being held captive in Vancouver from Portland, and her captor went down to the Minute Mart on the corner, and she actually got out of the room. I don't know how she got out of the room because he had thought he locked her in it, but she was running down the street in her underwear screaming for help, and finally somebody brought her in police. So it happens, you
yeah.
know. We cannot
yeah.
be in denial about that.
Deborah?
Yes?
This might be a good place for your quote. I can't wait to hear your quote for this week.
Well, I think that this was a difficult one for me to find a quote about, but here's what I got, and it's by Judy Chicago.
Uh-huh.
She's an artist from Chicago, and she's done some amazing work. Her most powerful work is called Around the Dinner Table, and you can look that up on the web. You'd be amazed by that. So her quote is, the acceptance of women as authority figures or as role models is an important step in female education. It is this process of identification, respect, and then self-respect that promotes growth.
I love that.
And I think if we can work towards instilling that in our children, that will be a step forward. So thank you for listening. We are three.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Three women.
Three women. Three, three ways.
Three women, three ways, three divas.
Yay.
Yay.
Until next Saturday at 10 a.m.
Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.